Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm James Dorsey, the host of the Middle East Studies channel. Today, we'll be talking to Ibrahim Freyhat about his new book, Iran and Saudi Arabia, Taming a Chaotic Conflict. Ibrahim's book is much more than an exploration of the history of animosity between Saudi Arabia and Iran and its debilitating impact on an already volatile Middle East. It's a detailed roadmap for a resolution of what increasingly looks like an intractable conflict. Ibrahim Freyhat, welcome to the show.
Thank you, James.
Perhaps we can start with you charting your intellectual journey that persuaded you to write your latest book.
Thank you very much, James, again. Well, I started actually this journey, very interesting, starting with my previous research book, which was published in 2016 about unfinished revolutions, Yemen, Libya, and Tunisia after the Arab Spring. And when I was doing my field research for that book in the remote areas in Yemen and in Libya and in Tunisia, and doing additional research for other research projects in Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine, you know, all over the region I've been for the past 10 years on the ground, I came to realize that I'm studying, or I was researching more of proxy conflicts, right, in many aspects, while actually most of these conflicts are linked to one major regional conflict that's taking place between Tehran and Riyadh, Iran and Saudi Arabia. So when I was done with my research, I thought, why am I researching, you know, the proxies? Why don't I go to the source, right, of these conflicts? As a conflict resolution specialist, I try to focus on addressing the underlying causes and conditions of these conflicts, not just dealing with the effects and the consequences of, you know, those conflicts. So it came very clear to me that the stability of the region, the Middle East and North Africa, to achieve this, you will have to address the source, or one major source, for many of these conflicts, which is, again, in Iran and Saudi Arabia. There is no point of wasting your time trying to sort out things in Yemen without addressing the regional component, the regional dimension of this conflict. Again, many see it as a proxy conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and you could see the rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia reflecting itself in Lebanon and so forth. So it became very clear to me that I have to go to the source, and that's why I immediately, when I finished my previous research, started researching this conflict. One additional reason, actually, is that though it is an extremely important conflict and playing a major role in the stability or destability of the region, there is a high level of confusion about this conflict. No one, you know, seems to understand, you know, what is going on and why are the parties are, what are the parties are fighting about? What's driving this conflict? Is it a sectarian conflict? Is it about, you know, regional leadership? What is it exactly about? And we're talking about a conflict that at least started since 1979 with the Iranian Revolution and what's called the export of the revolution from Iran to the region, and being understood by the Gulf neighbors as regime change in these conflicts. And we still understand, we're still arguing whether this is a sectarian conflict or what is it exactly. So because we still, you know, don't really exactly understand the sources, we don't understand the issues, there is no agreement on these issues and sources, and or even, you know, the way it's being run, direct confrontation between the parties or through proxies. So that's why I decided to call it, you know, a chaotic conflict. While Barack Obama talking about is an ancient conflict that's taking place, while others, you know, talking about, you know, some more immediate causes of this conflict, not exactly an ancient primordial conflict as Barack Obama wanted to describe it, is about Sunni Shia. So it's a chaotic conflict that there is no clear understanding or there's no clear agreement about, you know, the motives behind the conflict or the issues, you know, or even the means that they're fighting. And because of this lack of understanding and the importance of this conflict for the stability of the region and the peaceful and the peace of the region, I decided to give it more attention and continue investing my research in not only in understanding, which is, you know, the first part of my book talking about the understanding, but focusing the majority of the book is about the means, how to deal with it, how to manage it, how to resolve it, right? Which is, I think, what the both policy and academic debate needs at this time, is that not just keep talking forever about trying to understand what is going on, but hey, we need, you know, way more to, you know, someone to tell us how to respond to it, how to manage it, how to resolve it. And that's what I try to do with this research.
Indeed, that's a significant contribution of your book. You argue that the conflict is resolvable if properly managed. And I wonder what that means against the backdrop of the key ingredient for solutions, which is political will. And that usually only emerges when the cost of not resolving a conflict is higher than the cost of the conflict itself. And we don't seem to have reached that point yet, given that the current pandemic and global economic crisis has not changed Saudi Arabia or Iran's cost-benefit analysis.
You're absolutely right, James. One major reason why this conflict has not been resolved is that there is no good management of this conflict. And here I'm making the argument: in order to resolve conflicts, you need to manage them, you know, well first. That we need a better management of the conflict. Probably one major reason why the United States and former Soviet Union were able to manage and resolve ultimately their conflict and the Cold War not to escalate to a real war, is actually that they had a good management, conflict management system in place. We had senior level of visits between, exchange of visits between the two parties. We had open communications between the parties, hotline established, dialogue was continuing. But, James, we don't have any of that in Iran and Saudi Arabia. In 2016, sorry, is that we had, you know, the Saudi Arabia execution of Nimr al-Nimr, a Shia cleric in Saudi Arabia. And as a result, the Saudi embassy in Iran was attacked and led to, cutting really diplomatic relations between the two parties. So there are no direct communications between them. There is no exchange of senior level visits between the two parties. And in order to be able to continue to communicate, so I'm trying to propose ways to manage this. We need a hotline, to take a place is in order to prevent, any misunderstanding about the moves that could be taken between the two parties. So, in terms of experts committees on the technical level, that they try to address the issues and to try to come up with some solutions to their conflicts. There is no such thing. And in the absence of this conflict management system in place and to try to respond to the escalations, as you said, we have the pandemic and we have, the two neighboring countries. There are many challenges happening daily, and without a proper management system in place, the response will be always limited and this could easily escalate to direct confrontation between the two parties. And let's keep in mind that wars do not happen only in a top-down approach where leaders take a decision to launch a war against the other party. That's not the only approach of how wars start. Wars actually can be dictated from a bottom-up approach, like developments on the ground lead to parties having to make decisions and to respond to the other parties if there is no clear communications, no clear understandings, between the two parties. So the management system is necessary, and it's very important in order for us to try to put this conflict on a track for resolution. But nevertheless, you raise a very interesting point, which is about the cost, is that if there is no cost for this conflict, then it will go down, to the political will of the parties. Let's first of all remember that, and which is an important point of why the conflict is resolvable. Actually, we had just in the very recent history, during the times of Rafsanjani and Khatami, we had a really good managed conflict. And they were able to, to come up with some sort of agreements. In 1997, we had a security protocol established and agreed between the two, between the two parties. We had later even Ahmadinejad visiting Saudi Arabia. We had King Abdullah as well, So during the times of Khatami and Rafsanjani, we had everything almost under control, and we started to see collaboration developing between the two parties and became less influential in terms of the stability of the region and, better managed conflict. Now, the problem is in 2003, when the American invasion of Iraq happened, that led to the change of, the balance of power in the region was all totally shifted. Towards in favor of Iran, which the imbalance of power and the regional order, the change of the balance of power in the regional order led to this. So, with the question of the political will and the cost, I think now we are talking about probably the worst times for the two parties in probably the past 50 years, where Saudi Arabia now fighting a number of wars in Yemen, lost the war in Syria, also supporting Haftar in Libya, the blockade on Qatar, and at the same time, the relationship with the with the United States is not as stable and as strong and as good as used to be in the past, a very rocky relationship at the moment. Of course, with the decrease of oil prices, that we're seeing the lowest prices probably in history, at the moment. And for a country like Saudi Arabia, depending mainly on oil, you know, as the backbone of its economy. Also, we have the Hajj, the pilgrimage as well, season for the first time probably in probably a century, that we won't see a Hajj, a pilgrimage this year taking place, which should take place in 3 or 4 months because of the corona pandemic. So the economic sources are, you know, Saudi Arabia is seriously struggling in terms of the economy and to try to finance or to fund all these wars as well. But the situation for Iran is not much better, actually. Actually, that Iran also is going through also the harshest sanctions ever in history that's imposed by the United States on Iran at the moment. So with seeing an extreme case of harsh sanctions on Iran at the moment, and also Iran fighting or funding a number of civil wars as well, which is very ironic, actually, because it needs to look at their economy and to deal with the sanctions. But instead, you know, funding civil wars in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, and in Lebanon, as well. So I think those are very unprecedented times for both countries, for Iran and Saudi Arabia, in terms of both the economy and the politics and the engagement and the involvement of Saudi Arabia and Iran in these civil wars. This takes us, James, is to what we argue in conflict resolutions is about, you know, the ripeness for a resolution. And according to Zartman, talking about ripeness, is that conflicts become ripe for resolutions when the two parties reach what he calls the mutually hurting stalemate. And I think this moment, the mutually hurting stalemate for both Iran and Saudi Arabia has never been the case. In the past, in Iran was probably suffering more in terms of the sanctions, while Saudi Arabia was in a relatively better position compared to its relationship with the United States. But now it's both the stress and the mutually hurting stalemate is taking place for both. And according also to the theory, when the mutually hurting stalemate is reached, then a perceived or the two parties seeing a way out could be the right moment for a resolution. And I think because, again, we having, as we explained about the mutually hurting stalemate ever for both parties, I think now the time is ripe for a resolution, which I hope that leads to the political will that you raised in your question, and that the two leadership of both parties understand that the time has come for a resolution and they can jump on an opportunity to resolve it and to deal with their conflict differently.
It strikes me two things. One, there's a difference between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Iran is basically used to operating in a very hostile environment. A hostile environment, meaning the international community sanctions. This is not the first time that they're laboring under sanctions. They've always felt that they were on the defensive and under attack. Whereas for the Saudis, this is the first time that they're really confronting a situation like that. The other problem that I think we have is, and you've identified sectarianism and security as two of the key issues in the conflict. But you're tackling those problems, in a sense, with perceptions, or if you wish, misperceptions of one another that are woven into the fabric of the state and its ideology, and then are reinforced by the actions of third parties.
Yes. Sectarianism, I think you touch on a really major and hot issue, you know, for this conflict. And I think if we understand the dynamics of sectarianism and security, I think we can be talking about, you know, this their serious understanding of this conflict that we need, which is also what I call as one of the reasons why this conflict is not has not been resolvable, is that because we have a high level of confusion about what is really driving this conflict. So now let's talk about this. Sectarianism, that, you know, many analysts talk about it as that cause, or as Barack Obama talking about it as an ancient conflict driven by sectarianism. Now, sectarianism, I am making the argument in this book that it's not the cause of this conflict. It's not the original cause of this conflict. So they are not fighting about sectarianism, is about Sunni Shia. In fact, James, I really don't think that the two leaderships really care about sectarianism, right? That Saudi Arabia cares about Sunni Shia, or Iran cares about Shia, advancing Shia cause, or the way that people would look at it sometimes. I don't think they care about sectarianism. What they care about, and the issue of dealing with sectarianism. Sectarianism is used by both parties, right, as a tool to advance their political agendas, right? So it's a convenient tool. It's helping both parties to use sectarianism in order to advance their political agendas and achieve gains. Saudi Arabia, in this regard, would show it as, you know, Iran is advancing Shiism in the region, so it can mobilize the Sunni world around it, right? And also gain or establish, you know, regime legitimacy within also Saudi Arabia itself, because, you know, I'm the one who's standing up against Iran and preventing the spread of Shiism in the region. And Iran is doing it in its own way, that it's investing in the Shia communities in the region. It's not a coincidence that it's helping the Shia Houthis in Yemen, or the Shia militias in Iraq, or in Lebanon, or in Syria. So Iran is finding it also an opportunity to invest in these areas. So here's the thing. While sectarianism in this regard is not the cause and is being used as a tool to advance their political agendas, however, this sectarianism has become a cause of further escalation, right, of the conflict, right? So it's not an original cause, but it's a cause of further escalation, right, and spread of the conflict in the region, which now has become, or it became linked also even on the sectarianism is on the grassroots levels, where we're reaching, you know, levels of anonymity on the, you know, among the people, right? So in this case, while it's used as a tool, by the two parties, has pushed the conflict to a much higher levels and much dangerous levels than without the use of sectarianism. I think that cause of this conflict is about security. You know, security is not about the original cause of this conflict. It's about security of both parties. And both parties are facing serious security situations. That has led to what's called the clash of security needs between the two parties, and led to what I call in the book as the perceived encirclement of both parties and caught up in this security dilemma. How is this working? Iran responds, you know, as you also said, is seen as sees itself as under attack from particularly and primarily from the United States and Israel, and that the military bases of the United States surrounding Iran in the Gulf, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. So Iran sees itself as being encircled by the U.S. military bases around it from all neighboring countries. And Iran, because of this perceived encirclement, also responds by trying to expand its influence in the region in order to break this encirclement, and invests in building armed militias in Yemen, in Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon in particular. And what is Iran is causing or is leading in this case is that is in this kind of expansion of armed militias is causing encirclement around Saudi Arabia as well, right? So while the Iran is being encircled by the U.S. military bases, Saudi Arabia is also sees itself being encircled by Iranian armed militias from almost all sides. So this mutual encirclement, that's what is driving both parties to set up their conflict strategies in terms of escalation, and the hostility against the other party is trying to respond in a way that's being affected by the encirclement. They're responding in a nervous way. And expansion in the region. How do you break this dilemma? How you end this encirclement of both parties and to try to bring them to a solution? That's probably one of the major causes that's driving this conflict. So for Saudi Arabia to feel that the Iranian threat is real, they see it. They see it as real. It's in the to be seen in the armed militias in Iraq and in Yemen and the armed militias elsewhere. So security, and again, you know, the parties would lead to as well in terms of using sectarianism and all other methods as well. Now, we can't also deny that there is other major reasons contributing, which is when we talk about leadership. You know, with both parties are assuming leaderships of the Muslim world. Saudi Arabia sees itself as the leader of the Muslim world and also of the Sunni world, Muslim Sunni world. And Iran also appointed itself as the leader of the Shia Muslim world as well. Right. So with the Iranian intervention with the Shia community in the region, this also, as I said, is creating more tension in the region and creating more tension actually between, you know, in these societies, between Sunni Shia, for example, in Yemen. I used to go to Yemen before even the Arab Spring, before 2010. And the issue of sectarianism and Shia Sunni was never existed. You could never see it. But go to Yemen today and see how many things or the conflict that we're seeing, you know, in terms of sectarian prisms in the region, in Yemen.
I would agree with you with two caveats, if I may. What one is the perceptions of Shias themselves in Gulf states, whether the Shiite minority in Saudi Arabia or the fact that you have a Sunni minority ruling a Shiite majority, with little prospects for the Shiite majority in Bahrain, and until the overthrow of Saddam Hussein in 2003, you had a similar situation of a primarily Sunni minority governing a Shiite majority with no prospect of change. And so that, in a sense, gives it a flavor of sectarianism to some degree. The other caveat that I put is, you know, and I agree with you, for the regimes, it's not about sectarianism. But for Iran, if you look at the proxies, basically the proxies were almost a similar defense strategy to that of Israel. You fight your wars far from your own borders. And that's what they served. And it was also the fact that given Iran's economic situation, its limited access to buying weapons, that asymmetric warfare was almost its only option.
Yes. I think, you know, James, is the issue of sectarianism, I agree with you. And this issue of a minority ruling over a majority, whether it's in Syria and Bahrain and other places, I think there is a very unhealthy relationship with majority-minority relationships in the region. It's very unfortunate. And again, and I don't think this is limited, James, to the Sunni Shia cause, but it's also, if you look at other minority issues as well, look at also historically Iraq and the Kurdish community as well, or other minorities, whether in Egypt, in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Syria. I mean, the issue of minority has been a major issue in the region and has been a major cause of the instability of the region. So Iraq is in, Iran is investing in an area in a very unstable area already in terms of sectarianism, and supporting, you know, with what some scholars called it the Shia revival in the region, and that they're trying to reclaim their rights. And And I think there is level of seriousness about this, and there is a legitimate cause of that, how the minorities are not treated as, you know, citizens in a number of countries, but also when they became in power, like in Syria, also the Alawites minority in Syria as well. We saw even a worse situation than probably in Bahrain or in other places where the other side rules. So I think we need to fix this relationship between, which is the starting point, and as I address it in the book, a starting point actually for Saudi Arabia is to really build a strong strategy that can respond to Iran. And here I'm making the argument, while investing in arms sales and hard power is always an important factor in any conflict, but don't ever think that hard power is going to bring you peace and stability. But Israel, you brought up the example, is that is a nuclear state, but always calling, you know, for, you know, is all making the argument that does not feel secure in its borders and does not feel secure from the Palestinians, you know, that who have no army, no state, nothing. So peace can be achieved only, you know, through different means. Hard power, again, can be an important factor, but you have to reach peace through different ways. And to reach peace and stability and end the security dilemma for Saudi Arabia, I think it's one approach, one starting point, is through rebuilding its relationship with the Shia community in Saudi Arabia. Right? The Shia community, and as again I address in the book, when by you know, they're perceived as infidels by some extreme religious leaders in Saudi Arabia, or that, as one of them put it for me, that every Friday we hear in the mosques about, you know, being called as infidels and being treated as the filth column or as loyals to Iran. You know, so we have an issue here is that needs to be addressed, and a reconciliation within Saudi Arabia itself, with the minorities, with the Shia minorities, there, is actually will lead to strengthening the relationship and will lead to a stronger and more stable regime and more stable state from within. And that's actually what will enable Saudi Arabia to respond and be stronger in its conflict with Iran, right? Not feeling that the eastern part of Saudi Arabia as being the Shia community, as being loyals to external powers, to Iran. So through this, the forging, and it's not only about the relationship with the Shia minority and others, but also in the whole relationship, James, between state and society in Saudi Arabia, as a new social contract, you know, between the state and society, is what will enable Saudi Arabia, you know, to resist and to be stronger in its conflict with Iran. So through building your internal fronts and building a solid relationship between the state and society, and about building a state for its own citizens, so building and promoting citizenship as, you know, the cause of, or as the major core issue of the relationship between state and society, is what will make Saudi Arabia stronger. It's not the arms sales, right, that it's of investing $460 billion through arms sales from Trump administration. But then when the attack on Aramco months ago, that this arms sales, you know, could not stop an attack on Aramco in Saudi Arabia. So what is the point of the hard power investment in order to resolve and win this conflict with Iran? So it's the same thing with Iran. I think it's also, we have a troubled relationship in Iran from within. The relationship with its Arab minority as well in the western part of Iran. Also with Baluchistan and, you know, several other cases. We're seeing, you know, more executions. Iran is the second country in the world in terms of executions of its own citizens after China. So you need to address this relationship differently as well. And Iran, by investing with the relationship with the Shia in the Arab region, I think here they're reproducing their security dilemma as well. Iran explained the intervention of its intervention in Syria and in others, and also, as you raised in your good question, James, is that fighting its wars outside or far away from its borders. Iran explained this because fighting terrorism, fighting ISIS, fighting Al-Qaeda. But here's the thing, you know, when you're investing in supporting the Shia or advancing Shia, a sectarian Shia government in Iraq, supporting, that was one major reason why we saw, for example, the former Ba'athists and the Iraqi army allying with ISIS, the dissolved Iraqi army, I mean, during the times of Saddam, is allying itself with ISIS in order to hit back. So Iran, actually, while it claims as addressing its security dilemma as fighting ISIS and the Sunni extremism outside its borders, actually what it did by investing, by advancing a sectarian agenda, or advancing, using sectarianism to advance its political agenda, actually it caused a rise of Sunni extremism against it in the region. So it's reproducing its security dilemma, right, by using the wrong approach of investing in sectarianism and using sectarianism as a tool for its political agenda. So with that, I think both countries are running a counterproductive strategy, and that's why I call what I put as one major reason or one major approach to resolve the conflict, and for both parties, actually, to advance their conflict strategies and be more productive towards the resolution, is that the first step would be is to reform their conflict strategies. And reform can be can take place on many levels, investing in not only in changing their relationship and the way that they deal with sectarianism, but dealing with other aspects like their soft power, for example. Instead of using and investing all in hard power, Saudi Arabia is buying arms sales, you know, from the U.S. and investing in arm sales and arm race in the region, and Iran also using its economy in funding civil wars in the region, they can look at their soft power and what they can do in terms of their soft power. I think with their soft power, they can do much, much better things for themselves than just using the hard power in order to advance this conflict. And when I talk about soft power, I talk about, again, with Saudi Arabia, the Saudi Arabia needs to present itself to the world in a different way that it's perceived today. That it's not only about the relationship with the former Mujahideen in Afghanistan and the funding of madrasas in Pakistan or any other places, that Saudi Arabia became branded globally as funding or as a cause of terrorism through the funding and support of religious schools and ruling in a Wahhabi way and on that level. So this branding of Saudi Arabia must change. Saudi Arabia should proceed in terms of reproducing itself, reproducing its branding, and to try to present itself in a different way than what is the way it is currently being perceived. And also, when we talk about soft power for Iran as well, Iran is trying to expand in the Arab world, right? But never presented an appealing model, for the region. If you pick any person today in any of the Arab countries and ask them, where would they like to go? To go to Tehran or to Iran or go, for example, to Dubai, right? No one would tell you, I would like to go to Tehran. It's the Iranian model is not appealing to the people of the region. So you can't rule only by just keep investing in armed militias, right? And thinking that you can, as some of their politicians claim, the control of four Arab capitals and build an empire in the region. So Iran's strategy, so far has been all about creating instability, but instability in the countries where its armed militias are operating, in Yemen, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. But there is no one example where Iran actually presenting a model that it's building a state, it's building a new reconstruction after conflicts taking place. So the Iranians, in terms of soft power, Iranian image is probably the worst ever in the region, as a result, of course, of its supporting of the Assad regime in Syria and a sectarian Maliki government in Iraq as well. So Iran's image in the region has probably been the worst ever. And in order to change this and to run into more a productive rather than counterproductive strategies, you need to to reproduce the image, and present your image indifferently and your branding, differently than from being seen as funding armed and civil wars in the region. One important thing of how Iran, that I mentioned in the book, of how Iran actually damaged its image, not only in the region, but also in the world through its current strategy. Iran historically was seen as a victim of chemical weapons during the war with Iraq and Saddam's use of chemical weapons against Iran during the 80s. But listen to this, that we are seeing an Assad regime in Syria that's allegedly used chemical weapons against its own citizens, right, in Ghouta and in different other places. And whose primary ally and whose primary supporter in this is that Iran. So Iran's shifting place from being the victim of chemical weapons, as the case of during the times of the war with Iraq, with Saddam Iraq in the 80s, to being the victimizer or the ally, the primary ally of the victim of the perpetrator in Syria and the Assad regime's alleged use of chemical weapons. So this shift of its position, right, from being the victim to being the perpetrator in terms of chemical weapons, I think this has its image has suffered a lot, and it's unfortunate that Iran, who suffered from the use of chemical weapons, is to find itself in the same boat with a dictatorships in Syria, and the way this affects its branding and its image in the region. So again, I think the presentation of an appealing model to the region, and I think, and through the soft, its own soft power, is one way that Iran could help itself and could help the region as well, and engage more into productive and constructive strategies.
It strikes me that you're really talking about paradigm shifts, even to get to a conflict management system. And I agree with you. And the problem with that is, if you take the soft power example, the Saudis have changed their soft power strategy since the rise of King Salman and Mohammed bin Salman. But they've really done it only in terms of the facade and some low-hanging fruit. They haven't really done it in any degree of substance. And they've been their worst enemies over the last 4 or 5 years, in terms of projecting themselves in a different image. And by the same token, the Iranians, I mean, in the first year of the revolution, 1979, up until the Iran-Iraq war, did have an appeal. And the war fundamentally derailed the revolution, if you wish. One of those paradigm shifts, which you touched on in your book, was that you suggested that Iran could contribute to a resolution by no longer appointing itself the leader of the Shiite world. And it strikes me there that, one, the Iranians would demand reciprocity from Saudi Arabia, which would have far-reaching consequences, including, for example, the Iranian demand for an international or multilateral management of the holy cities. But also, if you drew a comparison to Israel, what you see is that it's up to Jews to decide whether or not Israel is their leader or central to their interpretation of Judaism. And increasingly, you see Israel's place in Judaism contested among Jews. And so the same process could take place if you had that level playing field, both among Sunnis and Shias, with regard to Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Thank you, James. This is a really great question. And in terms of paradigm shift, and yes, I am calling for a paradigm shift in both parties, and I agree with you totally that both parties, Iran and Saudi Arabia, touched on some paradigm shift and in terms of building soft power at different times. Let me begin with Iran. With Iran, during the times of Khomeini, when the early days of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, back in 1979, the early 80s, Iran and the Khomeini regime was calling for supporting the oppressed, and a different message was sending to the region, and in many different ways, and advancing justice and all of that. So I remember during the 80s, you could walk into many Arab capitals and you see the pictures of Khomeini in different places. I still remember that in Palestine, for example, used to hear even songs, right, for Khomeini, right, or in Jordan or in other places, right? If you go now in the Arab world and try to see where you see Khamenei's pictures, probably you see them in Sa'da in the north of Yemen, and you see them in the Dahia in Beirut, right, in the stronghold of Hezbollah there. But other than that, right, not sure where you will see an Iranian soft power or an Iranian model appealing, right, for the youth of the region on for the land. So this changed Unfortunately, it shifted, but shifted to the opposite side, where the Iranian model is no longer appealing and is no longer seen as a friendly country where, you know, people can live with peace and harmony in the region. But other than that, we haven't seen any changes. We see the opinion pieces that Jawad Zarif writes in the New York Times. But by the way, that I think they lead to really bad results rather than really changing. They're making things worse, you know, because when people read them here, I mean, and they look at their action, right? So it's really counterproductive also for, you know, for Iran is to be using its primary soft power strategies, writing Jawad Zarif's writing opinion pieces in the New York Times and thinking that people would welcome that. People look at your action, and then when they see a discrepancy between what you say and what you do, this actually further undermines your image and leads to an issue of credibility there. Now, in terms of Saudi Arabia, and I think you asked the right question about, hey, we are seeing Saudi Arabia leadership is or has started this paradigm shift in terms of its soft power. We saw for the first time allowing women to drive, so changing this important thing, and also fighting corruption and all that. And I think this can be or could have been really the a really good start for Saudi Arabia of, again, rebuilding its image globally and to try to show some serious steps in terms of changing its relationship, you know, on the domestic level and on the and internally. Unfortunately, these changes tend to be handled in the most counterproductive approach, actually, and lack serious credibility about what reforms are Saudi Arabia really doing, right? And in terms of fighting corruption, and we heard about, you know, the Ritz-Carlton, you know, prison, turning the Ritz-Carlton to a prison for the wealthy Saudis and, you know, fighting corruption. But we saw this not done in a meeting the minimum standard of the transparency, right? Allowing them for you know, to have access to lawyers and to try to, you know, fight back on their terms of, you know, charges of corruption or another day. So it's done. It was done in the most secretive way. We don't know how it was done. We don't know what was the standard that was used in those finding corruption. And on what ground? Actually, they were arrested and put in prison and asked to surrender parts of their wealth and be released. And some of them actually there came back, like the former Minister of Foreign Affairs, who was one of the Ritz-Carlton's people, that after being released and supposedly for, you know, charges of corruption and then being sent back and as being the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia. So that's not done in the most transparent approach taking place on that level. And of course, you know, we have the elephant in the room that undermined, you know, the reform agenda or the reform image that Saudi Arabia, which is, you know, the assassination of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the way it's done and the way it's handled. And I don't think Saudi Arabia has till now, or probably in the foreseeable future, would be able to recover from this this scandal about the way, you know, murdering the you know, the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. It became the biggest nightmare for Saudi Arabia's image and Saudi Arabia's, you know, credibility in Saudi Arabia's leadership, and raised serious questions about what kind of reform are you really doing, right, on that level. Now, let's not also forget some other examples. that the New York Times and Wall Street journals also mentioned about the Crown Prince purchase of high expensive artifacts and some other houses in Saudi in France and other places. So which raises a serious contradiction between fighting corruption and what you're really doing in terms of buying fancy houses and other places. So according to these articles by the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. So the whole issue of reform with those kind of examples in Saudi Arabia also has been questioned, and it lagged credibility and the people being able to trust that what's happening is genuine, what's happening is serious. I think Saudi Arabia still has an opportunity to genuinely engage with political reform in Saudi Arabia, fight corruption, release those people in prisons that also the charges are not clear while they're still in prisons, without transparent way of dealing with the prisoners and all of that. So I think this became, instead of a paradigm shift, to rebuilding its image and rebuilding its soft power, it became a liability. It became counterproductive. And we need probably another paradigm shift, is where you can convince the world and convince, most importantly, your own citizens that you're running a free, fair way of engaging with the society, building a new social contract between society and state, and trying to advance this in a more transparent and credible way.
In a lot of ways, I think one could describe the history of the Saudi-Iranian conflict as a history of missed opportunities. Unfortunately, we're running up against the clock, but I do want to squeeze in one last question before we go on to the final part of the interview. And that is, from a Saudi perspective, it strikes me that Iran is an existential threat, irrespective of who rules Iran, simply by what it is. And what I mean by that is several things. One, it's an alternative form of government, of Islamic governance. And Saudi Arabia doesn't look kindly on alternatives to its governance. On top of that, Saudi Arabia, in the larger a stretch of things, is hardly a competitor in a world in which Iran would be unshackled from sanctions, given Iran's geography, given the size of its domestic market, given its history and science of scientific achievement that goes back half a century. And in fact, in that world, it wouldn't be Saudi Arabia, but it would be Turkey and perhaps Egypt that would be Iran's main rivals when it comes to regional hegemony.
That's correct. And I agree with you, James. And I think, during our research and doing this this book, which where I met many Saudis and people from the Gulf and Iran, and we challenged the Iranians on this level of the relationship with their neighbor, with Saudi Arabia, and they used to always tell us that we don't see Saudi Arabia as our rival in the region. And actually, according to them, is that stability of Saudi Arabia is in our own interest. And in order to have a stable country on our borders, that we don't have to deal with ISIS and instability and Sunni extremism. And they made the argument many times that, so it's in our interest is to keep Saudi Arabia a stable country. And as you said, there's, the rivals is somewhere else. According to them, it's primarily Israel and the United States in the region. The way they see it. Yes, there is a concern for Saudi Arabia here, but Iran is not the only country, right? You have also Turkey as well, who also presents history and scientific achievement also in Turkey as well. I don't think Saudi Arabia should need to worry about this if they're able to really build a strong and stable state that, again, build on a new social contract within Saudi Arabia. Build your own internal domestic front in the most serious, credible way of partnership between society and state. And you don't have to worry about Iran on that level. At the end of the day, Iran, I don't think Iran is going to invade Saudi Arabia or is going to engage in serious regime change in Saudi Arabia. And also here where I call for the solution to this is that the rebalance of the regional order. And as I explained well, is that again, since 2003 and the shift of Iraq's position to Iran's side, this has led to rebuilding a regional order on that level. And I think if this is a major area of concern for Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia has options. You know, they have they can build a strong relationship with Turkey and with Egypt as well, right? This could counter the Iranian influence and engage in a more rebalanced regional order. But you can't also for Saudi Arabia fight Iran and Saudi Arabia at the same time. I think this is wrong, right? And this is like the results of Saudi Arabia's foreign policy, that the way they're running. You have also, you know, Pakistan is on the other side. That's Pakistan's primary interest, is in the stability of the region, because the last thing that Pakistan would like to see is an advancement of sectarian conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia, because Pakistan's army, you know, is a split also Sunni Shia that has been it. And if a sectarian conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia would reflect itself in the most serious, you know, bad way in Pakistan, that Pakistan wants to avoid. And bringing Pakistan to the to this composition or to the regional order, I think would rebalance in a way. So Saudi Arabia has many options to rebalance the regional order, whether it's through the relationship with Pakistan or building more of an alliance with Turkey. Does not have to fear Iran and whether Iran is going to expand and take over Saudi Arabia. Now, the starting point for rebuilding the regional order and address that exactly the point that you mentioned, James, is the way I presented in the book will have to be Iraq. It all started in 2003, the rebalance of the regional order in Iraq, the change of position in Iraq, and has to go back to Iraq. And by that, I'm referring to, I'm not supposing or I'm not arguing that Iraq will have to shift position again to Saudi Arabia. No, it's totally the opposite. It's in Iraq's interest is to be free, independent from interventions, whether it's from Iran or Saudi Arabia or any party in the world. So advancing Iraq's independence is in the interest of Iraq is first, and the stability of the region, because Iraq is free from Iranian influence, will address the imbalance of the regional order that was created in 2003. And I think there are many Iraqis who are aware of this. Barham Saleh many times has, you know, sent this message and emphasized this message, advancing Iraq that's a totally independent Iraq from the influence of not only its neighbors, from any party in the world. And this is the right of the Iraqis. Also during that right after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, there were many Iraqi voices, right, that they started talking about, don't turn Iraq to be the battleground of this new conflict. Again, is advancing the message of independent Iraq. We are seeing also, we have seen in the past couple of years, protests against Iran in Iraq. And one examples of Shias themselves protests in Karbala and in Najaf, also attacking the Iran's consulate in Karbala, and also raising their concern about the Iranian intervention in Iraq. So again, independent Iraq will address also the regional imbalance of power, would could provide also some assurances to Saudi Arabia and the trust in the regional order if we see that is happening as well. But again, Saudi Arabia has many choices and they can address it instead of advancing conflict with Iran in order to address this component and not to be afraid of Iran and the way Iran's building its influence in the region.
Ibrahim, we could go on for another hour. I think I've at best posed half of the questions I jotted down in preparation of this conversation. But unfortunately, we're running really up against the clock. Before I let you go, I wonder whether you could tell us a little bit about where you go from here, what your next project is.
Thank you, James. It has been really a very interesting conversation with you. And as you said, it's really, we can't stop just talking about these issues. So this, the interesting thing here, James, to answer your question, is that it's one research project that's leading me to another research project. As I started saying that my previous research was on unfinished revolutions in the region has led me to this research. And now this research is leading me to another major research question that I am researching. I started already, is about, as a conflict resolution specialist, is about why mediations, international mediation, is not working in the conflicts in the Arab world. We have seen international mediation taking place in many conflicts in the region that for decades. In Western Sahara, we've seen UN mediation since 1989. Still, there is no progress. Still, the conflict is going on. American mediation in Palestine, Israel, since Oslo Agreement in 1993, and then starting a lead peace process in 1993 that turned to be a process without peace and an endless mediation of U.S. Role in this conflict. We've seen the UN changing five or six mediators in Syria since 2011. We've seen also the UN changing mediators in Yemen from Jamal bin Omar to Wilde Sheikh to Martin Griffin with no peace being achieved, with no conflicts being resolved. The same thing applies to Libya, Ghassan Salami and others, Tariq Mitri and others. Also, UN envoys with no peace achieved there. So what is it about Arab conflicts that where mediation doesn't work? Is it the problem of the conflicts, the mediator, the issues of this conflict? What is it about? So I'm trying to ask this research questions. While other international conflicts, mediation works and then to a certain extent, we're probably seeing the lowest success level of international mediation in Arab conflicts, and I'm trying to shed light on this larger regional perspective on why mediation is not working and where the problem is and how can international mediation be improving in Arab conflicts and be more successful, hopefully.
Ibrahim Freyhat, this has been a fascinating conversation, and equally fascinating is your current research project, which I can't wait to read. Thank you for being on the show, and all the best.
Thank you, James, for this really interesting and scholarly challenging conversation. I love your questions and the way you challenge my arguments. I could go on for a long time, but I'm sure we will be talking again soon. Many opportunities of experts like you in the region, we will always end up finding ourselves talking about the conflicts in the region. Thank you, James, for this really interesting.
Absolutely. Thank you.